From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. People who tune into this show know I love talking about saints and future saints. And the young future saints are especially inspiring. And people like Blessed Carlo Acutis. And we'll be talking with Courtney Mares, the author of a brand new book, A Saint in Sneakers. And also we'll be talking about Venerable Montse Grasses. We'll be talking with Marie Oates from Opus Dei about the 17-year-old girl who's on the path to sainthood as well. And check out my latest book, Science and the Miraculous. It was highlighted just this past Tuesday in the Washington Post. So you can check that out, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural, out from Tan Books and available at EWTNRC.com. And you can check out my television series on EWTN, Explore with the Miracle Hunter. It airs every Saturday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Tonight, I'll be traveling to Naples to probe the mystery behind St. Januarius. On his feast day, the dried blood of this 3rd-century bishop martyr is said to liquefy, a sign that no harm will befall the city. So check that one out. That's one of my favorite episodes airing tonight. Later in the show, we'll be looking at the 365 Days with Mary Project. For today, June 17th, we've got Our Lady of the Forest from Dolina in Austria in the year 1849. And the might-be saint of the day is Blessed Alberto Leccapecori from Italy. He died in the year 1154. And the question of the week is a good one. Must a healing miracle be used for a canonization? So we'll be answering that later in the show. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we talk about the miracles happening all around the world and those that relate to miracles. And there was a miracle that's being bandied about or considered for the first member of Opus Dei, that religious organization founded by St. Jose Maria Escriva from Spain. And there was a man named David. He was suffering chronic pain and partial paralysis, and there was no cure for what he had, only palliative medicine. But he actually did a novena, and when the doctor saw him, he had walked into the doctor's office on his own power with his own 2 feet, and he and his wife were in the office, and the doctor didn't even remember him. And they asked him how he could be so healthy. And the doctor examined him and said, "You are indeed cured." And when they filled out the medical paperwork, they had to write prayer was the reason for this cure. And the prescription was keep on praying those novenas. And so his name was David Rodriguez Nieto. He's from Velacas, and it's near Madrid. And they were praying through the intercession of this future saint, a venerable, whose cause is up for canonization, and it's a miracle that that David is submitting to Rome, or he's working with the vice postulator to submit to Rome, because it's absolutely amazing. And there was no medical treatment that related to the cure, and at the end of 9 days, he was absolutely cured. It was what we might call an instantaneous cure. So truly a miracle. Venerable Isidoro Sorzano is the name of that first lay member of Opus Dei, and perhaps this miracle will lead to his beatification. Find out more. I posted that article on my Facebook page of The Miracle Hunter. You can find out more about this healing and perhaps the process of what will be happening next. Let's take a look at Catholic Club Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer who gets the right answer. And people who know me know I love trivia. And so on any given night, you might find me at a bar playing pub trivia. But this is Catholic Club Trivia, so it's a little bit different. So last week's question, name any one of the canonically crowned images of Mary from the United States. And some countries like the Philippines have 30, and in Italy they have a huge number as well, and the United States is a very small number. And so from the United States, we have Our Lady of Prompt Succor from New Orleans, and Our Lady of Mount Carmel in Manhattan, in Our Lady of the Immaculate Conception in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and Our Lady of La Leche at the National Shrine of Our Lady of La Leche, which was just crowned in the year 2021, so very recently. So those were the four. If you got any of those, you win the prize, or you got the right answer anyway, and we'll see if you have the answer next week. The question this week, we're talking about Blessed Carlo Acutis, somebody who died in the year 2009, so is a very recent blessed. Who is the most recent person, non-martyr, to be declared blessed in the United States? The question again, who is the most recent non-martyr to be declared blessed in the United States? If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com or just go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Marie Oates from Opus Dei about Venerable Montse Grasses, a 17-year-old on the way to sainthood. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. I love talking about saints and future saints on this show, and young future saints are especially exciting to talk about because it can inspire young people to look towards Christ. And of course, in this episode, we're also talking about Blessed Carlo Acutis, who's caught a lot of attention because he was a young saint dying from leukemia, and he's now a blessed and on his way to sainthood with some miracles under consideration. And people who are familiar with my show, They Might Be Saints, which airs on Fridays on EWTN, also know of another young future saint who we talked about in a previous episode, and that was Venerable Montse Grasses from Spain. She's a member of Opus Dei, and she's on the path to sainthood as a venerable. With one miracle, she becomes a blessed, a second, and she becomes a saint, so she's well on her way. Well, we're so excited today to talk with Marie Oates from the Opus Dei Office of Communications to talk to us about this up-and-coming future saint, Montse Grasses. Welcome back to the show, Marie.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much. And I get excited to talk about these future saints, especially the young ones, because people can find inspiration in them. And I think it's such a great thing. And Montse's story is a good one. It's one that for all of us who suffer from different medical conditions or whatever the suffering is in our life, she is such a great model for us. And so before we get into sort of the end of her life, let's start from the beginning. Who was she? Who was Montse Grasses?
So Montse Grasses was actually born Maria Montserrat Grasses Garcia, and her she was known as Montse. She was born in Barcelona in the Catalonia region of Spain on July 10th, 1941. She was the second of nine children born to Manuel Grasses and Manolito Garcia. So that's kind of her story. She was a normal kid. She had normal issues. Would get ticked off at her siblings, just normal.
She wasn't born with a halo, right? She was just a normal kid, and I think that's pretty inspiring. And she liked to do the things that average kids like to do, the things that she was involved in. Tell us about her day to day. What she spent her time on?
Well, she was not a bad student, but not like a great student. But she was athletic. She liked to play. She liked to, play basketball with her friends and hike and do things the kids like to do. She was very spontaneous, open, fun-loving, had a lot of friends, very gregarious, responsible kid at the same time as one of the older children. As she got older, she did mature, and she was more responsible for her younger siblings, but really a very normal kid, with the things that people do, normal, nothing out of the ordinary.
And of course, sainthood, saintliness is for all of us. We're all called to be holy. And so she's such a great example of somebody who lived an ordinary life, you might say, who found holiness, achieved it with heroic virtue, when she was declared venerable after her death. What were the circumstances, would you say, under which her virtue was formed or best shown?
Well, her parents were both devout Catholics. They actually were both members of Opus Dei, which married members are known as supernumeraries. So they really tried to create a bright and fearful Christian home. They tried to raise their children in the Catholic faith. And when she was about 13, her mother took her to a center of Opus Dei called YAR, that's L-L-A-R. The double L in Spanish sounds like a Y. Right. And that's a women's center of Opus Dei, and it offered, it was like what's called a clubhouse, sort of after-school activities and programming, so cooking. They would also offer classes in French and English and piano. And she was 13 when she first went, which was kind of young. Usually those clubs are for high school kids. But she went, and she loved it, and they would go hiking. She developed a lot of camaraderie with the girls there. So amidst all these activities, they're also trying to teach young women virtue, Christian virtue, teach them more about the faith so that they actually have an intellectual grasp of the truth of faith and just to, you know, grow closer to God. I mean, that's really the idea behind the activities of Opus Dei, is to help young people in these programs to be souls of prayer, that they learn to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And she certainly did that. She loved going to the club and would invite her friends to go. And she really grasped the spirit of Opus Dei, which is to find God in the ordinary of everyday life and to live Christian virtue as you carry out your work and offer your work and your studies up to God and offer your fun to God and just have this sense of giving the ordinary things back to God. So she loved that. That was very attractive to her, and she absorbed it pretty quickly and would invite her friends to go. And I think this helped her as a young person grow much closer to God in sort of an accelerated way, which would really benefit her, of course, because she ends up getting bone cancer and dying at a very young age at 17.
Yeah, let's talk about that. As a 17-year-old, she would be one of the absolute youngest saints in the history of the Catholic Church if she did reach sainthood someday, and she's well on her way as a venerable. But let's talk about those times of her diagnosis and her early days of struggling with the cancer. What was that like for her, and how did she handle it?
I think initially, she had pain in her leg that she felt, and they didn't diagnose it. They didn't diagnose the illness right away. They thought it was just sort of a problem or growing pain. And then ultimately she couldn't sleep and she really was in a lot of pain, and they did a biopsy. And then her parents kind of kept it from her over the summer, that they knew that it was serious bone cancer, which today probably could be treated, but back then it was terminal. And so when they finally told her, she received the news with faith. I mean, I think with a certain seriousness, but with faith, and she accepted God's will. And she prayed for a cure, but she also was open to whatever God ultimately wanted. So she had a lot of faith. And as she got closer and closer to death, the more proximate she was to death, the more she actually became excited about seeing God and just moving on and going on to eternal life, which I've heard that of other people too, when they're terminal and they have a lot of faith and they just get in the zone. And that's what it was like for her right at the end.
Amazing. We're talking today with Marie Oates from the Opus Dei Office of Communications about Montse Grasses, a venerable who's well on her way to sainthood and died at the age of 17. And so when they launched her canonization cause and examined her life, they said that she lived a life of heroic virtue. What would you say are the virtues that were highlighted in her positio or that were presented to Rome that led to her being declared venerable?
I think that people repeatedly characterized her as someone who was very much for other souls. She very much was about other people and serving them and putting others first. So in the midst of her, even before she was sick, this was part of the quality that she had. But when she was sick, it was especially apparent that she tried never to let the illness kind of dominate a conversation, or she had many visitors of her friends come over, and she would inevitably turn the conversation back to them and ask them how they are, and really didn't want to dwell on herself or sort of be a victim. Like, that was very alien to her. That wasn't what she thought God was calling her to do. She was much more a soul for other souls, to help them. She's very cheerful, very optimistic. She had a tremendous sense of offering her pain and her suffering as a sacrifice, kind of the way Jesus did on the cross for souls. So she had a tremendous sense of like this priestly soul of like, I'm going to offer all these things up the way Jesus did for us. I'm going to do this myself with what I have and give that to God. So she would do that. She would transform her suffering and her pain into prayer in that way. So I think these are some of the things, just a lot of faith. I mean, she had a lot of faith, she had a lot of spirit of service. She was very optimistic, very selfless, would forget about herself. I think these were things that people focused on.
No, that's absolutely wonderful. We're talking today with Marie Oates about Monse Grance. It's a event named Venerable on April 26th, 2016. And so how does the canonization cause move forward at this point? I know that she advanced from servant of God to venerable, and with two more steps, she'll become a saint. But what is the process, or what is the activity of the cause for Monse Grance now?
Well, I think the activity is that we want people to be praying the prayer card to her. There's a prayer card that's available. I think you get to it through the Opus Dei website, so www.opusdei.com. That's opusdei.org. And then put Monse Grance in there. And you'll get to her, you know, her web. She's got like a sub website in there. And there's a prayer card to her. And ask her to grant you a favor. You know, people, listeners should go to her. And then when there's a miracle that, you know, when a favor is seen to be a miracle, then she will move on to be beatified. I mean, she kind of gets in line, and then the Holy Father decides, you know, with the help of his consulters.
That's right. No, it's a very long process, and it's been streamlined in recent years, you might say. But for some saints, they've waited hundreds of years. So let's hope that it's much faster for Monse Grance.
But I hope so, too. And I hope your listeners take advantage and ask her for things, because that's what we really need is people to go to her intercession, to ask God to let her, you know, do some favors so that she can take the next step. That would be really fabulous.
Absolutely. And we can seek her intercession and hope that results in favors and miracles, and we can pray for that. And another aspect of Monse Grance, I think, is a great example for us. Even though she died young at the age of 17, her lived experience, both in joy, with her friends and family, but also how she handled suffering, is absolutely a great model for us. So if you had to sort of point people to Monse Grance and her virtues and say, now here's someone that we should emulate, what would be the characteristics that you think that people could focus on?
Well, I think I've alluded to them earlier. I think we live in a culture right now that can be too self-focused, and we can too easily make ourselves kind of victims or feel that we're misunderstood. And she offers that's kind of not a really good Christian outlook. I mean, certainly we all have suffering, and we got to recognize that and work through it and find meaning in it. But you don't want to dwell in a kind of victimhood. That just doesn't really get people anywhere. And it's, from a Christian point of view, it's not really helpful. Jesus is the real victim, I mean, for Christians. He's the one who kind of took it all on. So when you point to Monse, I would say she's great for young people who could be tempted to want to make themselves feel they're victims of I don't know what, you know. And she offers a way out. She shows how close union with God, close union with Jesus Christ and prayer can help you turn that around and focus much more on other people and to kind of get out of the orbit of self and to be thinking more about others. That's the Christian way. That's like the little flower, the St. Teresa of Lisieux, not to confuse this all with lots of different saints, but that's really the spirit, I think, that she espoused and demonstrated and would be very helpful for young people and not so young people.
Absolutely. Great reflections today from Marie Oates from the Opus Dei Office of Communications about Venerable Montse Grasses, who died at the age of 17 and is on the path to sainthood and would become one of the youngest saints in the history of the Catholic Church when she makes it all the way to the finish line there. So we're so grateful to you, Marie Oates, for joining us on today's program and talking to us about this great future saint, Montse Grasses. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Michael. It was a real pleasure.
God bless. That was Marie Oates from Opus Dei talking to us about Montse Grasses. You can find out more if you go to opusdei.org to find out. You can do a little search for Montse Grasses there, and you'll get to her prayer card. You can also check out the episode that Marie helped with producing. We did an episode of They Might Be Saints on Montse Grasses. So you can go to ewtnrc.com to pick up the DVD for that, or you can watch They Might Be Saints on Fridays on EWTN as well, and eventually her episode will come up. But it was an absolute pleasure to put that story together. She's an incredible future saint in our Catholic Church. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And I love getting these questions, and I love doing question and answer when I give a talk. I travel around the country and maybe give 20 talks a year at shrines and conferences and parishes, talking a lot these days about Eucharistic miracles. For people who want to invite me to their parish, you can find me through my website, miraclehunter.com. Just click on the contact tab. And so we get a lot of questions about sainthood causes coming into the Miracle Hunter inbox. And one of those questions that we got recently is a good one. The question is, must a healing miracle be used for canonization? Another way of saying that, are there any other types of miracles that can ever be used for canonization, or are they always healings? Well, it turns out that 99.9% of all miracles that are being considered and approved by Rome in the Congregation for the Causes of Saints, or the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints, as it's known now, they're almost all medical miracles. Why is that? It's because there are x-rays and MRIs and medical tests that sort of establish the condition, the disease, the illness, the state that the person is in. It's well established, and that's what all the doctors look at when they prescribe treatment or they try to help that patient. And then after this miracle is going to happen, they can also run them through the same MRI and x-ray and medical tests that show that the disease or condition is gone. So there's a one-to-one comparison between the two. It isn't the person felt better, but we don't have any proof of what they had originally. No, the medical tests show proof positive that something very different is there. And so that's why medical healings are used. And of course, people pray in a big way when they've got a serious medical condition. That's a cause to turn to a saint for a special healing. But have there been other cases of non-medical miracles that have been used in canonizations? And so we have cases like Blessed Juan Macias in Colombia. There's this food multiplication miracle where at a homeless shelter, there was the chef showed up one day to cook for the homeless shelter with hundreds of people there, and they didn't have enough food. They were out of the rice and they were out of the meat. And so he prayed to Juan Macias, and as he did so, the rice kept multiplying and the meat kept multiplying, and they had enough food to feed the entire community room there. So that was a non-medical miracle. And then we also talk about Blessed Irene Stefani. There's a miracle that happened, I believe, in Africa, where there was some people who were huddled in a church. They were escaping the warring tribe that was after them, and they didn't have any food or water, but they did have the holy water font there, and they drank from that font until they could escape safely. And it kept refilling and refilling and refilling, and it served all those people there. And it wasn't being brought in from an outside source. It was just the little bit of water that was in the holy water tray that kept refilling. And that was for Blessed Irene Stefani. And that is another non-medical healing miracle. But I don't know many more than that. There have been very few and far between that aren't medical miracles. So thank you so much for your question about healing miracles for canonization. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com or just go to my website, miraclehunter.com. You can send me a message that way. Maybe we'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we talk about the Marian devotion of the day as it lines exactly up to the day's date. And we talk about Our Lady of Fatima, May 13th, or Lourdes, February 11th, or Guadalupe, December 12th. But for each and every day of the calendar year, there's a different title of Mary, probably a lesser known one than those big three. But there's a different one for each and every day of the calendar year that lines up to a feast day or the building of a basilica or a famous miracle. So Mary has appeared and been in our hearts for every day of the calendar year. So for this week, we've got Our Lady of the Forest from Dolina in Austria in the year 1849. And the story goes that the Blessed Virgin Mary appeared as the Immaculate Conception on June 17th, 18th, and 19th to three shepherdesses to prepare the public proclamation of the dogma in 1854, that dogma of the Immaculate Conception, of course. This began an influx of pilgrims into the woods to the place where she had appeared. A wooden chapel was built and a painting created from the testimony of these children. And a local artist painted a picture called Madonna del Bosco, Our Lady of the Forest, inspired by the descriptions of the three shepherdesses. And this painting was a picture of grace that inspired the faith and devotion of many. And so that is Our Lady of the Forest, Madonna del Bosco, from Dolina in Austria in the year 1849. For more information on this fascinating devotion or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can check out 365dayswithmary.com. You can join the Facebook page with 10,000 followers, or you can download the free app, 365 Days with Mary. Now let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We do this every week where we talk about those people on the path to sainthood. We talk about servants of God, venerable, blessed, before they've got all their miracles and they're declared saints by Rome. And so we always like to keep you up to date on what new saints are coming down the pike, and we give you the sainthood news. And so last month, the Holy Father, Pope Francis, in audience with His Eminence, Cardinal Marcello Semeraro, the head of the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints, they had an audience, and the Pope authorized this Dicastery to promulgate a decree regarding the heroic virtue of the servant of God, Edda Rhoda, born Edda Maria Caterina. She's a professed nun of the Institute of the Capuchin Sisters of Mother Rubato, and she was born on October 30th, 1940, in Leno in Italy, and she died on June 16th in Bergamo, also in Italy. And according to the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints, she was a professed nun of the Institute of the Capuchin Sisters. She was faithful to the rules of her congregation. She abandoned herself to God's will, and she transfigured her suffering into an offering of love and just her illness for a path of purification to unite herself more with the Lord. And so that was Edda Rhoda, who was just declared venerable. With one miracle, she will be declared blessed. A second miracle, she will become Saint Edda. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints, the Might Be Saint of the Day. Every day on the calendar year, there's a different servant of God, venerable, blessed, who has a feast day or a death anniversary on each and every day of the year. So we've got Blessed Alberto Lecce Pecore from Italy, his feast day on June 17th today. Now, he was born to a wealthy Corsican noble family, and Alberto became a career soldier. And the shock of seeing his brother die in combat caused him to reevaluate his life and he found his call to religion. He left the military to become a penitent layman at a monastery of San Vito, and then a wandering monk preaching in Italy and France. And at one point in his wanderings, he met Ranieri Scaccarsi, and after an evening of talking to him about life and faith, it set Ranieri on the road to sainthood. And so he died of natural causes in the year 1154, and he in Paris, in France. And with one more miracle, Blessed Alberto Lacciapecore, he will be named a saint. And for those people who are interested more in They Might Be Saints, you can pick up the book, They Might Be Saints, available from EWTN Publishing. You can go to EWTNRC.com for that, or you can go to EWTN Television and watch on Fridays, They Might Be Saints. This week, the episode on Father Augustus Tolton will be airing. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Courtney Mares about her new book, A Saint in Sneakers, about Blessed Carlo Acutis. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People ask me a lot about future saints. I do that series on EWTN on Fridays called They Might Be Saints. So people say, who's your favorite They Might Be Saint, or who or might be saint, or who do you pray to the most? And my answer is always the same, and that is Blessed Carlo Acutis. And you probably know that name. He's so popular in the Catholic blogosphere and otherwise. Articles all around the world reference the young man who died from leukemia and had such a great propensity for working with technology, especially in things like miracles, Eucharistic miracles and Marian apparitions. And I kind of consider him the patron saint of MiracleHunter.com, because when my site crashes or I need help, he's the future saint anyway that I pray to. Well, there's a brand new book out about Carlo, and the name of the book is A Saint in Sneakers, and that's out from Ignatius Press. And the author is Courtney Mares, who is a Rome correspondent for Catholic News Agency. We're so excited to welcome to the show today, Courtney Mares.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here with you.
Yeah, it's great to chat. And truly, Carlo Acutis is one of my all-time favorite modern saints, and he's a great intercessor for me. So I was excited to see your book. And I think that your title hits the nail on the head exactly, A Saint in Sneakers. Maybe he's someone for the average amongst us, for the common folk. He's just for the young. He's a saint who appeals to everyone. So when we talk about Carlo Acutis, we also talk about somebody who's extremely popular. I think that people see the need for evangelization of the young, even, and for models of holiness to be presented to the young. So many books have been written now about him, and yours joins the fray. So the question for you out of the gate is, why did you write this book, and how is it different than some of the others that are out there?
I remember first hearing about Carlo's story about 5 years ago, and just being fascinated, like you said, about the fact that there was a computer-coding teenager born in the 1990s on the path to sainthood. And with technology changing at such a rapid pace today, I think that Christians are still grappling with the idea of how best to live out our faith in a world filled with smartphones and laptops and social media. And Carlo's life really gives us a concrete example of how heroic virtue and sanctity look in the 21st century. But I think, to be honest, I even surprised myself by taking on this book project, because I have always loved the more, shall we say, dramatic saint stories of heroic martyrdom under extreme persecution or daring and dangerous missionary journeys to foreign lands, whereas Blessed Carlo is more of what Pope Francis would call a saint next door, or as in the title of my book says, a saint in sneakers. And I think that this is precisely where Carlo's story challenged me and challenges us, because he lived a life of heroic virtue by living a relatively normal life for a kid in the 1990s and early 2000s. And I think it can be easy for us at times as Christians to simply tell ourselves, oh, if I were an early Christian in Rome and facing extreme persecution and had to die for my faith, of course I would be a martyr. But Carlo is someone who died in 2006 and lived in a time not far removed from our own, kind of takes away our excuses or rationalizations for not putting God first in the everyday circumstances of our lives. For example, if we truly believe that Jesus is present in the Eucharist and that this miracle occurs in every Mass, why don't we make more of an effort to pray in front of the tabernacle, to receive the Blessed Sacrament as often as we can, to tell everyone we know about it? And Carlo also challenges us to find ways to use all of the incredible technology that we have at our disposal now, not only for our own entertainment or wasting time with endless scrolling on a cell phone, but to really do something with all the technological resources at our disposal to help build up the kingdom of God. So I think there's just so much that we can learn from Carlo's story at this time. And for me personally, it was a fun project also because I was born only a few months before Carlo. So I had a blast looking back at the culture of the 1990s and early 2000s, especially the early internet culture, which we all know is a little quirky, and how that helped shape the life of a future saint. And also being based in Italy as a Vatican journalist, I was also kind of in the right place at the right time. I was here living in Italy and working as a journalist during the pandemic, and I was able to attend Carlo's Beatification Mass in Assisi in 2020 at a time when Americans weren't allowed to travel to Italy for tourism. And I also went on to travel to Carlo's hometown in Milan, Italy, where I interviewed some of the people closest to him, including a man who converted from Hinduism to Catholicism thanks to Carlo's witness.
Amazing. We're talking today with Courtney Mares, the author of the new book, A Saint in Sneakers, about Blessed Carlo Acutis. And we talk about Carlo being an average kid, but then in so many ways, he's not an average kid. And I think that especially when you look at the religious practice of parents, all the data shows that if two parents are practicing, the child is very likely to practice, and especially if the father is practicing, the data really shows that the child may be a practicing Catholic. But in the case of Carlo, we have to ask the question, how did Carlo become so faithful, especially when he kind of converted his own parents or was a model to his own parents of faith?
Well, I'm sure if you were to ask Carlo, he would point to the Eucharist as the source and summit of his own personal sanctity. One of Carlo's most famous phrases is, "The Eucharist is my highway to heaven." And he also said, "People who place themselves before the sun get a tan, while people who place themselves before the Eucharist become saints." But Carlo's parents have attested that their son showed a special love for God at a very young age. And it's remarkable that neither of his parents were practicing the faith when he was born. And Carlo was actually introduced to the Mass and the Rosary and other Catholic devotions by his Polish nanny, who his family had hired when he was very young. And as Carlo entered elementary school, he kept asking so many questions about the Catholic faith to his mother that his mom had to seek out the help of a priest to get catechized herself so that she could answer her son's many questions about the faith and slowly learning more about the why behind Catholicism and also seeing the witness of her son who, you know, loved God at such a young age with such purity, drew not only Carlo's mother, but both his parents back to the church, so much so that Carlo's mom has called her son my little savior.
Yeah, it's incredible. A beautiful, beautiful reflection of his mother. I interviewed his mother a few weeks ago, and of course, that's great to hear her behind the scenes, up close and personal with her son. And one question that's always kind of intrigued me is we see Carlo as sort of this this young man who stands out amongst the rest, And we call him a normal child. But then you also have to ask the question, when he was at school, amongst his peers, amongst other students, how did he do that anyway? How did he, how was he a model of the faith? How did he spread the gospel amongst those kids when we were all kids once and we all know how tough it is, and it would be especially tough to spread the gospel? How did he go about doing that?
Yeah, my book is just filled with testimonies from Carlo's classmates, his friends, and family members about how he brought so many people closer to God. And one of the ways he did that was Carlo was a very open person, and he was not shy to speak with his classmates and just about anyone he met about the things that he truly loved, the Mass, the presence of Jesus in the Eucharist, and heaven. And he had a lot of courage to bring up these conversations with the people in his everyday life. I know one of Carlo's classmates who had not been baptized said that Carlo had several conversations with him in school about what baptism means and why it's so important. And with other friends, he spoke about the importance of going to Mass and confession, about chastity with his high school classmates and human dignity. Many of his high school classmates remember one instance where there was a classroom discussion about abortion, and Carlo gave a passionate defense for the protection of life from the moment of conception. He was not afraid to defend church teaching, even in situations where, you know, some of his peers disagreed with him. But if you look at how Carlo was able to spread the gospel in school, you can't also failed to mention the fact that Carlo was a good friend, and he found joy in helping others, and he befriended a classmate who was struggling socially in school, and he also took the time to be there for another friend who was going through a tough time because her parents were separating, and he told her, God sees you, he knows how much you suffer, and God will always be there with you and protect you. But it was not only with his peers. Carlo also inspired adults to convert, not only his parents. As part of the research for this book, I interviewed Rajesh Mohair, a man who converted from Hinduism to Catholicism because of Carlo's witness. Rajesh had worked for the Kudus family as an au pair when Carlo was young. And as part of his job, he helped bring Carlo to and from school, and then would also bring Carlo to daily Mass. And Rajesh would sit in the back of the church and watch Carlo pray and observe how Carlo's behavior changed as soon as he entered the church and was in front of the tabernacle with such reverence and devotion. And while still an elementary school student, Carlo taught Rajesh how to pray the rosary and told him about the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. But one of the things that impressed Rajesh the most as a non-Christian was the witness of Carlo's care and concern for the poor, how this little boy interacted with a homeless man who would sit at the entrance of the church and would bring Tupperware of food out to the homeless.
Yeah, truly an amazing life, and all the way to the end, even in his death with leukemia, he carried the faith all the way to the end. We're talking today with Courtney Mares, author of the brand new book, A Saint in Sneakers, from Ignatius Press. We are, of course, talking about Blessed Carlo Acutis today. And one of the aspects of Carlo's life that I'm particularly interested in, and many people around the world have highlighted this, is his interest in technology. And he built some websites about Eucharistic miracles and Marian apparitions and things of this nature. How was he inspired to build these sites and use this technology to spread the gospel? What was his idea of that?
Carlo's spiritual director has attested that Carlo was personally convinced that the scientific evidence from Eucharistic miracles would help people to realize the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist and come back to Mass. And for 2.5 years, Carlo worked with his family to create an exhibition on Eucharistic miracles that premiered during the church's year of the Eucharist, proclaimed by Pope John Paul II, and has since gone on to be displayed at thousands of parishes across 5 continents. And Carlo used his computer skills and internet savvy to research information about different Eucharistic miracles around the world He also traveled with his family to several Eucharistic miracle sites in Europe and helped take photos for this exhibition. One of Carlo's favorite Eucharistic miracles was one that took place in the Italian town of Lanciano, where a monk was full of doubts as to whether the consecrated host was actually the body of Christ. And one morning while offering Mass, the host he was holding changed into flesh. And the reason why Carlo was so interested in this particular miracle was because of the scientific analysis that had been done on the transformed host. One study found that a sample from the transformed host was cardiac tissue, and that the blood belonged to the AB group, the same blood type documented on the Shroud of Turin. We see this also with another Eucharistic miracle found in Acutis' exhibition that occurred in Buenos Aires in 1996, at a time when Pope Francis was actually the Archbishop of Buenos Aires at the time. And a scientific study done in New York in 1999 found that a sample of the transformed host was not only heart muscle from the wall of the left ventricle, but that white blood cells were present in large numbers, meaning that this tissue was from a heart that was alive and pumping. And the fact that studies on these Eucharistic miracles have revealed that the Eucharistic host transformed into heart tissue also brings to light a spiritual reality that connects two of the great feasts we are celebrating this month, Corpus Christi and the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And Carlo himself saw this connection. One of the quotes attributed to him is, "The Sacred Heart of Jesus is the Eucharist." And Carlo was really convinced of this and wanted to use all the means at his disposal to try to share this information with others.
Yeah, it's truly amazing. His work on Eucharistic miracles, I've seen that exhibit in my own parish and seen it at many parishes as well. People need to find out more about Carlo's work on Eucharistic miracles. And I agree with him. When people learn the science behind these occasions, they'll really be blown away. And as we wrap up the interview today, tell us, what is your hope for people who pick up this new book, A Saint in Sneakers, and where can they go to find out more about you in this book?
My hope is that the book will draw them closer to Christ. That was my prayer throughout writing this book. And I think one of the major themes running through the book is technology and how Carlo lived a heroic life in our digital age. So I pray that people will be inspired by Carlo's witness of how he navigated kind of our complex digital age and remain rooted in the sacraments, in prayer. And I just hope that Carlo will be, you know, Carlo was the first millennial to be beatified and by the Catholic Church to be declared blessed. But I hope that he is the first of many. I hope he's the first of a generation of saints from millennials and Gen Z, and we'll see many more saints who have used technology and the internet and you know, their own creative gifts that God's given them to spread the gospel. As for me, you can go to CatholicNewsAgency.com, where I publish daily news articles about the latest news from the Vatican. And you can also find my book on Amazon or order directly from Ignatius Press.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Courtney Mares, for writing this new book about Blessed Carlo Acutis. The name of the book is A Saint in Sneakers, available from Ignatius Press. Thanks so much, Courtney, for joining us on today's program.
Thank you, Michael.
And that was Courtney Mares. Check out that book at ignatiuspress.com, and the name of the book, A Saint in Sneakers. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Courtney Mares, talking about her new book, Saint in Sneakers, about Blessed Carlo Acutis. And also Marie Oates from Opus Dei talking to us about Monte Grazie, a venerable on the path to sainthood as well. Check out my EWTN television series, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Tonight, I'll be going to Naples to probe the mystery behind St. Januarius. And his feast day, the dried blood of this 3rd century bishop martyr is said to liquefy, a sign that no harm will befall the city. And check out my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural. It was just featured this week in the Washington Post. You can get that through Tan Books on EWTNRC.com. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter. We're from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events. Whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.